Hi, this is Jack Cassidy of Hot Tuna, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon, Dave's Gone By, on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, everyone. Shalom, goddammit. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon with you here talking about something that I love as much, if not more, than the theater, rock and roll music. And when you think of rock and roll and blues and folk and country and jazz, one of the people's names that you come up with is the great bass player for both the Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. His name is Jack Cassidy. He's actually on the Electric Ladyland album working with Jimi Hendrix on Voodoo Child. There's a bass made by Epiphany that has his name on him, a whole line of basses. He is the winner of Bass Player Magazine's Lifetime Achievement Award, and I should say that writing for Premier Guitar Magazine, Greg Olwell wrote, Jack Cassidy is virtually unparalleled, and yet he has one of the most truly unique electric bass voices in rock. He can melt into a supportive role, but when opportunity knocks, he bursts forth with a creative line, both simple and ornate, unlike any you have ever heard. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the neighborhood, Mr. Jack Cassidy. Shalom.
Shalom. All I gotta say is oi.
Oi.
Get all this stuff.
Now, oi shouldn't come that difficult to you because you are at least partially Jewish, Jewish and Irish, right?
The story is Grandma Kolesky, Rose Kolesky, ran off with John Cassidy back around the turn of the century. And then my father, they had two sons, my father, William Robert Cassidy, and Charles Warren Cassidy. They were both doctors and dentists. And,
of course.
And then Bill Cassidy had three sons, and one of those sons learned how to play guitar.
Oh, guitar first and then bass?
Guitar first, in 1956, when I was 12, yeah. And I think about 1957 or so, that's when I met my lifelong buddy, Jorma Kalkinen, in Washington, D.C., and we went to the same school, but we were about 3 years apart, and we started a little band in high school called The Triumphs.
The Triumphs. And by the way, just so people know, Jorma Kalkinen is also half-Jewish. So if you put Jack Cassidy and Jorma Kalkinen together, you actually have one whole Jew.
I don't know what the mix comes up with, but it's so American. That's the way things are done, and that's why people came to America, so they could do things their own way and have the freedom to do that.
Now, when you first started learning or teaching yourself guitar, who were the people that you were mimicking or learning from or aping from records and sheet music?
Well, one of my favorites was Jim Burton. Of course, he played on at 14 years old, he came up with that iconic line for Susie Q, Dale Hawkins. Of course, then he did all the Ricky Nelson records. I always thought that he used to have such a unique voice and still does in his approach. He does that chicken pick approach he holds the pick with his thumb and first finger, but then the second and third finger he would do the individual picking, kind of like Jorma does. He puts a thumb pick on the thumb, and then he's got the first and second finger to pick the individual notes. But there was many jazz players, that I liked. I loved Wes Montgomery, and I loved Charlie Christian was probably the first guy that I heard, and I still have the records on my iPhone. The great thing about the iPhone is I just finished downloading this radio series that Charlie Christian did with Benny Goodman that was recently released.
Wow.
And to hear all these different takes on all these great songs, the iconic songs that Benny Goodman put out.
Did you know that?
In any case.
Yes, yeah. I was just going to say that Benny Goodman, also Jewish. Charlie Christian,
yeah,
not so much.
Quite a few. Quite a few. If you're going to go down that line, there's a long list. But those were early guitar players, simple stuff like Link Wray and whatnot played at a local club on 10th Street, and then Jorma and I played. And I remember we had a show that we opened, it's a little dive on 10th Street in Washington and a club scene. And those were the kind of things, that were really a simple chord-oriented kind of repetitive stuff on the guitar, but it first got the precursor to the distorted sound, that really just raw sound on the guitar. Of course, the jazz guys thought it was very unsophisticated, but it meant a whole new approach. And that approach, I think, came in a good part because the solid body Fender guitar, both for guitar and then like the Telecaster, and then later on for bass, like the Telecaster version of the bass. Then it was called a Precision, but it looked like a Telecaster. Those were just coming into being in the late 50s. And so that was a different kind of guitar sound that came in compared to the F-hole body guitars, you know, that had a little smoother sound. And that role that was in rockabilly with the Gretches and the Gibsons, that moved over into, a lot of that stuff moved over into solid body guitars.
I'm a little shocked that you used the phrase F-hole on my program. I've been called that a few times, but never on air, yes.
Well, you know, archtop.
Hard top. Well, that can be a little filthy too, but only if you're
arch. Arch top. Come on.
All right. Okay. Now, you were interviewed at one point, and you said that what distinguishes a bass guitar player, or perhaps any guitar player, more than anything else, more than even learning some other filigree or a style, so to speak, is tone. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think tone is, you have a great violinist, and it's about the tone. You know, you hear a stringed instrument with your flesh is on the string. You have that opportunity to hear unique and great tone from the player. And I think wind instrument, you know, and how you build your armature and just the makeup of the way you approach the instrument, it sets you apart. And I think everybody has their own tone. I mean, you may not like it or not, but everybody has their own unique stamp. It's like the DNA. It's only yours.
So even if
you do with that and how you develop, that's another issue altogether. But I always said that tone is that seductive nature of the sound of the music that draws you in closer to the music without you really knowing why. This is not the melody, and this isn't the fancy chords, or it isn't the lightning speed playing, or anything else having to do with so many levels of music. It has to do with the humanness of the music.
Let's say you're rehearsing or on stage with Paul McCartney, right? And he hands you his bass. It's exactly it. He hasn't touched it except for playing it. He hands it to you. It will sound different in your hands, correct?
You bet, because he's left-handed in the end.
Oh, well. That too. Okay, that, I mean, a fair question. Hey, but another right-handed bass player, even the same thing.
Not the instrument, it is the musician. A musician can make a fairly poor quality instrument sound really a lot better than somebody who can't play.
What's the best instrument that you've ever picked up and handled? That either you own or you were in a museum or somewhere and you just held it and you were like...
No, right now I have to, and this is no BS, but right now it's my Epiphone Jack Cassidy bass. I helped develop the pickup on it. And for the electric F-hole instrument, I can do more with that with my hands. I can change and manipulate the tone so much with my hands. And I find that to be the best all-around instrument, particularly in the format of playing acoustic hot tuna that we do. I'm facing a guitarist with Jorma Kalkin with uses a thumb and two fingers and picking. That's low volume playing. That's not thrashing. That's individual note playing, like two hands on the piano. And with that, I can get many tonal varieties out of the instrument just by using my hands. And that's what I like about an instrument. I don't reach down to do knob settings or any of that kind of thing.
Now, you sound like you've taken serious music theory. And also, I think you also teach in groups and summer kind of things. But have you done that? Have you studied music really seriously?
I am studying now more seriously than I have my whole life. I mean, I think it's a continuous adventure and a continuous exploration of what you don't know.
I'm also talking not so much the playing and fingering, but the whole literal theory of music.
Well, I'm talking about that.
Yeah, you are, yes.
When you start to teaching, I've been teaching out at the Jorma Kalkin and Fur Peace Ranch Guitar Camp in Southeast Ohio for 16 years since it's been opened. And, of course, when you have to explain to people and to your students why you do something and why it makes sense, then you have to study about how it all works together. by teaching, I think that it requires you to do a lot more investigating about your playing. I didn't have formal teaching in the sense of a classical instrument because I started playing guitar. And the guitar wasn't considered a legitimate instrument until Segovia basically put the guitar in the classical world on a map by making slaving over these classical pieces and making transcriptions that would fit the six strings in the guitar. I didn't study piano as a child, where you have that opportunity to have the full spectrum of the orchestra and your 88 keys and the theory that generally goes along with that. So I'm starting to catch up now.
Well, let me also ask, you are not a young man, but you're not yet an old man. You got some years, God willing, you have many years in front of you.
God willing, you said.
But have you felt a certain physical change or slowing down in fingers? Do you have to worry about arthritis? Do you have to worry about just the basic age?
I've got some arthritis. I have to warm up more. Everybody should always warm up. Even when you're young, you should be required to warm up properly. Any athlete, anybody that uses their muscle groups in a regular fashion, you know, we'll see the advantage of warming up. Now, as arthritis begins to creep in, there's certain things that if I launch into really fast songs right off out of the gate, my hands are cold and we've been playing in 6 degree weather like we've been doing all month, I have to pay attention to keep my hands warm and warm up slowly and get the muscle groups and the tendons and all of that up to the right temperature, you know, and then I'm okay. So, yeah, there's all of that. And I think you adapt to your playing, but also there are different aspects you work on. You know, I'm very interested in note placement, not how many notes I can cram into a measure. So as you advance into the depth of the musical world that you're moving through and the time that you have on this earth, I think, of course, you start out, you know, in your 20s and you have this tremendous reservoir of energy and physical depth of field for your muscle structure and whatnot. And all that can become a lot more delicate as you get older. But that being said, it doesn't mean it takes the fire out of your playing at all. It just means that you adapt where you have to. If you find that you're a different person at age, I'm nearly 70, I'll be 70 April 13th. And
happy almost birthday.
An attitude and a different, you want different questions answered at these ages than you do when you ask questions in your 20s.
Well, are there specific things that you have learned from teaching at the Jorma Kaukonen Fur Peace Camp Ranch thingy? Something that dawned on you, a light bulb went over your head and over the past 10 years?
I think that happens all the time. I think that's the process. We teach a 4-day weekend and you sit down and I teach through songs, which is my format. And I have a Pro Tools set up and I have the players play with tracks and then sort of put their bass parts of music into the music that I pre-record. As I watch them do that and listen to how they approach the instrument, I try to shore up their playing. At the same time, you're listening to how it all works and how it's all put together. And I think that's always a learning process for me as well. Anytime you show somebody something, you're really reviewing about how you do it yourself.
That's a magnificent pedagogical thought right there. And I've never heard it put that way, but that's lovely. And by the way, we are talking with Jack Cassidy, the musician, the bass player, the member of course, the Jefferson Airplane, and then Hot Tuna. Now, let us roll it back. Let us talk about these things that you've answered a million times, but we have to hear them again because it's our social and rock and roll history. Your friends with Jorma, how did Jefferson Airplane come about?
Well, the Jefferson Airplane came about, and of course, this is all, you know, you can
of course
all this, but you know, it came about in July of 1965. I came out and joined them in October. Jorma had been asked to join this so-called folk rock group in 1965, and when I still kept in touch with Jorma as he moved out to the West Coast, I was still in Washington, D.C., and going to school there. He was going to school out here, and through a chance conversation one night at a mutual banjo player's house, you know, and I asked him what he was doing, and he told me, and I said, "What, you the purist playing in a rock and roll band?" Well, it wasn't rock and roll band, it was folk rock, right? So, in any case, he invited me to come out and join, because at that time he didn't even out there, and then we got our first recording contract about a half a year later.
Did you realize that you guys were making something special, or did you just feel like you were another rock and roll band trying to make a living scrapping along?
I think the latter was probably more prominent, but we thought something special was going on in San Francisco in general anyway. Mm. So there was a lot of bands forming in different ways that they had in the past. It wasn't leader side man cutthroat music business like on the East Coast, you know. So the positions and standings within the band were all equal, in our band at least. And so when we went to sign our first contract, it was very unique in that we all put our signatures down on the RCA contract.
And it couldn't really stay that way forever, though. I mean, Jefferson Airplane had a good run.
Well, that did stay that way forever. And that's why when the band ran its course in 1972, and Norm and I decided to put the brakes on to that, that's why it didn't appear again ever as the Jefferson Airplane, because it had to be the original five people. So that's why Paul started Jefferson Starship. He asked us if he could use the word Jefferson, and we said, God bless, go right in. And we started Hot Duna. So yeah, bands run their course. But what I described before, it was always, still is, you know, we were all equal members of the same band.
But I just kind of wonder, like, why couldn't, I mean, in a theoretical sense, why couldn't...
Hey, why does a marriage do? Why can't all marriages last?
That's...
The persistence, you know. Don't forget, everybody's young, and everybody is growing and developing their musical talents, and there's only so much time, so much space and all that for one band. And I think the strength of that band is we had pretty drastically different inroads of personality from the players. The weakness of the band is that as you develop and want to move on, your development starts to stop in a certain direction if you only get, you know, one or two songs on a record. You know?
Right.
You're young and impatient, you want to concentrate on direction. Norm and I wanted to concentrate on driving. The Airplane had sort of run its course with the politics waning in the early 70s and different styles starting to come in. It just didn't seem as relevant then anymore like it had from 1965 through 1970, say.
But conversely, you guys formed Hot Tuna in 1968, and you have not run your course. As a matter of fact, you're going to be at Denver's Oriental Theater tomorrow, on Sunday, February 23rd. So,
what a magnificent segue.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. You knew I had to throw that in there. You know, I'm trying to push the thing. But also to say, the difference is it's you two guys, and yet you've managed to stay both friendly and musicianly and in the same band for, I can't do the math, 78, 88, 98, 08. Well,
there's a couple of things. Jorma often jokes that the reason we're still together is because we've never had a band meeting. And in a sense, he's correct. I mean, we used to have this horrific band. It's just knockdown dragouts with Jefferson Airplane. Ultimately, all kind of based on somebody just trying to cram their point of view down to somebody else's throat. But I think in any dynamic, the players and the people within the dynamic, whether in whatever business it is, whatever union it is, whether it's a marriage or whether it's a business or a team competition or anything, it's knowing what your role is. And if you're always climbing to get the other guy's role all the time, you know, then you're always stepping all over each other. You know, I don't pick the song lists. You know, I may make comments of them, but Norm is the primary singer, and he is the singer. I don't sing. So, you know, why should I be saying, oh, well, you made the song list up all these years. I want to make song lists up now. You know, it doesn't make sense, and that's how it is with a lot of bands. People want the other roles that they see other people have and see it as a rule of strength. So you have to consider where your territory is, and that can move around, and that can have influence in its other ways. There's other ways to influence the events of things besides in a demonstrative way as well. So I think patience and realizing, trying to step back and see the whole picture rather than have it sabotaged halfway through for some silly reason is what will add to the longevity. But also, Norm and I have reference points that go back before some other thing, which we're not very often, we can always make a comment on friendship, on our mutual upbringing in Washington, D.C. There's of him coming over to my house when he was a kid, and my mom, Mary Cassidy, fixing him a roast beef sandwich, and me coming over to his grandparents' house, and having something there, hanging out. You know, we've got other reference points. It isn't all just, like, associated with
the music. Yeah, it was before. Did you go to each other's bar mitzvahs?
Oh, I didn't have a bar mitzvah.
Oh, my God!
I didn't have a bar mitzvah. But, you know, my father, technically, I guess, would be considered Jewish because his mother was. But he was not raised in a Jewish household. But I love smoked whitefish.
Oh, dear. This is exciting to know.
And I know about pickled tomatoes.
Pickled tomatoes? Wow, you are getting old. Yeah, well, the stewed carrots, not so good, but pickled tomatoes, interesting.
Yeah, I know a good dumpling.
Let's also, because people, of course, want to hear and know a little bit more about that whole West Coast scene that you mentioned. Would love to know, first of all, do you remember any encounters you must have with, let's say, Jim Morrison and the Doors?
Well, we shared some bills together, you know, and we some shows. And you know, our primary recording, the first four albums or so, was down in Los Angeles at RCA. So we came down here, and we would check out all the LA bands. And they were part of the LA band scene, you know, the Birds and the Doors and various players here in Los Angeles. So we'd go, you know, we'd fly down. I love it. You love this. We'd fly down on PSA for $12.
Oh, my God.
Fly from San Francisco to Los Angeles for $12.
That's still more than I make doing radio, quite honestly. But okay.
And check the other bands out. You know, we were on bills later on together as we all got some prominence, you know. Then later on there were festivals and all that kind of stuff. You always check the other bands out, you know. But I knew the guys, you know, but I didn't know them really intimately.
You don't have, like, any special anecdotes, let's say, about talking with...
I'm not telling any tales right now.
Oh, how come?
I'm old school. No tales out of school.
Well, come on, it was the 60s, it was the West Coast, it was drugs and women.
No, but we saw, you know, everybody was hanging out, everybody was young, you know, and you had tons of energy, and you finish your gig, and if there's another gig still going on with other people, you stuck your guitar in your fist, and you marched over, and there was a lot of jamming going on, and it was a great period of time, I would say, between 65 and early 70s.
Well, isn't that kind of how you wound up on Voodoo Child, on Electric Ladyland?
Well, I did that because Jimmy had come out to the Fillmore, and Bill Graham was our manager. And he came out to the Fillmore, and we co-shared bills, and later on at Winterland and whatnot. But when Jimmy went through his first couple of albums with Chaz Chandler and then started on his double album, and Chaz was dropped, Jimmy was able to produce it himself. And so then he could try different things out. One of the things, we were in New York doing, I think, the Dick Cavett show or something, and afterwards, that had taped early, we went over and saw Traffic at Steve Pohl's Scene in New York City. I remember, and Jimmy came in with a bunch of the guys. He was recording with later on with Ladyland. We all hung out and talked and yeah, because we knew we had met each other and done some jamming and at the Fillmore in our rehearsal hall, which was at a synagogue next door.
No kidding.
Bill Leafs and invited us all over, and as he was working, and we were just hanging out and listening to him record, and then he said, you know, about 7:30 in the morning, let's do a blues track. I think he recorded a faster version before, and so we broke it down into a slow version, and we did a 15-minute version. We didn't think anything about it, because about 8 in the morning, we got in our LTD station wagon, drove down to D.C. to do a gig, after being up all night, of course. And then a few weeks later, he gave me a phone call, Jimmy did, gave me a call in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and asked if I mind if we put that track on the album. And I never thought it was going to end up on the album because it was a 15-minute track. But those were the rules that were being broken now. And I said, sure, go ahead. What was interesting was, as you must remember, up until that point, there was AM radio, and FM radio was primarily used for classical music and other kinds of programming in the mid-60s. It just started started to come into being, where stations, maybe a classical music station hadn't lasted or something, and you had a more open format, and you'd have a DJ that could play anything he wanted. He didn't have to go through a payola list like on the AM radio. So then you had these all night, you had these slots open up like from 12 midnight to 6 in the morning, nobody else wanted. And you had these DJs that would come in, and they would start to play then what was the counterculture music, so to speak. And they would play all the cuts on the album. And albums started to be, to move from being a collection of singles, like they had been up to that point, to full concept albums of where a working band, all the musicians being the same, you know, the Rolling Stones, the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, the Quicksilver Messenger of a Service, the Doors, the Birds, later on, Crosby, Stills, Nash. You started to approach your album in a way that showed the development of that band at that point. That's why there's a drastically different sound to the first Jefferson Airplane and the second Jefferson Airplane album, and aside from the fact that Grace Slick had entered the band and Surrealistic Pillow album. Going into the third album, with After Bathing at Baxter's, we put our own jam on there that was 10 minutes long or whatever, and the song started to expand beyond a three-minute format. You had a format for this stuff to happen. The Cream put out an album that made everybody go bonkers, you know, and go back to Woodshed and want to play better. So you had now an audience that, would, because of a variety of means, was somehow finding themselves awake all night long. And listening with groups of people that were somehow finding themselves staying awake all night long, listening to these radio stations, and the music would blossom, and then they would come to your shows and be very familiar with everything that we were doing. Hello, this is Jack Cassidy of Hot Tuna, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on UNC Radio, Dave's Gone By.
Now that music has changed so much, or at least the way that music is disseminated, do you think that the idea of a full concept album may go the way of the dodo, or will it turn into something else?
It certainly is funny that when I grew up in the 50s, you know, you bought singles, and then you bought the albums that were collections of singles. You know, I'd buy all the Chuck Berry singles, and then you'd come out with the album that would have all of that. Maybe a couple of tracks for what they call B-sides then, you know. Or maybe there'd be a track on the album that you hadn't heard before that never got released as a B, even a B-side on the A-sides of the singles. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you have people downloading singles again. But I think that's changing a lot again back, because people get tired. People aren't fools. So you have a like Daft Punk. You know, I love that band. They put out their Dance Approach album. It's masterful, with a variety of guest artists on it and singers. Paul Williams, that track that he does, is fantastic on that album, with so many others. And then you have people that start to buy the whole album again. Do you hear the order of the tracks?
Mm-hmm. My goodness. Said.
Tell that hello. That's a good boy. Yeah.
That's Paul Kantner in the background, ladies and gentlemen. No, just kidding.
That's my 105-pound Rhodesian Ridgeback.
Nice.
Somebody coming in my driveway.
As long as you mention that you like Daft Punk and you're listening to that, what else are you listening to these days?
Oh. I listen to Daniel Maison. He's an electronics musician out of France. I listen to all kinds of stuff. You know, I like to download combinations of compilations of a lot of European music and a lot of music from all walks of life, and then discover. So I kind of make a budget, a monthly budget of myself. A certain number of dollars goes into random access. So I can discover stuff. It's not a great one for a listing of artists, because I think it's, in a certain sense, it kind of gives the wrong impression. But I do fan out to many different kinds of styles, you know, and try to rediscover stuff, you know.
Now, are there songs of recent vintage that you and Yorma have covered in like live performances or stuff like that, some recent songs, or is it all original stuff?
Oh, no, we do all kind of, you know, we run the gamut. We've always harvested out songs of traditional nature and mixed them in with...
with what you guys do.
Our set. I mean, we're working right now on Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? It's a, you know, great song, and Yorma's worked out a really interesting and fleshed out a great arrangement on the guitar, and we're slowly piecing that together. But at the same time, he's written a whole bunch of new material. So we're always folding those two things together, because I think, basically, if you think of yourself as a folk musician, you present different viewpoints. And I think that's the nature of why I think our music seems to resonate through generations when we play shows, rather than have the music like the Jefferson Airplane be oriented around a time, you know, when you graduated from high school, a certain great time of your life or something like that. Yeah, I think you have to chronicle the things that go on around you, and you present them out in musical form. Some people are writers, and some people, you know, song crafters, and some people musicians, and you put it all out there.
Speaking of having it all out there, do you regret the pharmaceutical era and the amount that you ingested?
Oh, I can't do anything about it, you know? I mean, I don't think... I think for it served a purpose for 5 minutes. You know, for some, it opened up certain venues to them that maybe they wouldn't have ever discovered on my own. For me, it very soon became an impedance rather than an enlightenment.
So for a few months, it was, oh, wow, very spiritual, helped you with music.
You know, a time frame on it. I mean, it had its purpose. You know, I'm taking psychedelics or mind expanders and whatnot at the same time. After you have the revelation that you can't remember the next day, you do that too many times, and it doesn't really add up to too much.
So was it easy or hard for you to give up the substances?
Oh, definitely. I would say no, the LSD and all of that, no. Not at all.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, some people, you know, they take one bad hit and they're done for life.
I'm a clean and sober guy for 24 years, coming up February 25th.
McMazel.
So there's nothing I miss. You know, I got as high as you can get. I got as drunk as you can get.
But now you get high on
music. The rest of it, it just doesn't do anything until it just ruins your life.
Well, what do you do when you're not playing music, right? And playing with your Rhodesian Ridgeback? What are your hobbies, Jack Cassidy?
You know, it took me probably 3 years to get back in my skin when I stopped all that nonsense. And my primary evil doer was alcohol for me.
Ah, right. So do you still attend meetings?
My Irish heritage, you know. And it doesn't matter what it is, any of that stuff that's out there. If it masks, then you have to ask, you know, what is it? What are you gaining and what are you losing?
Why did you... I mean, because 25 years ago was a while, but it's not like 1968, so why did you continue with at least alcohol for all those years?
Exactly.
What was it masking?
You know, for me personally, I started when I was 12, you know. I mean, it was out there, and it's part of my DNA, so to speak, you know. To get back in touch, you know, it took me about 3 years to actually get comfortable inside my skin again. Because, you know, you're used to always having something, you know, it doesn't matter. You might be marijuana one day, and then you switch off to alcohol, you have the alcohol, you stop the alcohol, and you have a little this or a little that, you know. So it's always something. But if you strike that always something out of there.
Well, what were you able to replace it with?
A green drink that is so dark in color. This is kale? It's a who? A Hulk? Oh, the Hulk? The Incredible Hulk drink. Okay, gotcha.
Oh, boy. So that's what you replaced it with.
I'm going to have a little sip of this right now.
An energy drink? Well, it's better than drinking Jack Daniels, I'll tell you that.
Well, of course, this has nothing to do with my obsessive compulsive nature, so that therefore, you know, I go on these, you know, I love juice fast and all these kinds of things. Oh. You know, I do all these type of things. And have fun with it, you know. I love to ride my bike.
Oh, that's good.
And hike in the mountains and do all that kind of stuff. So, you know, to me, that's, you can't do that. You don't do that stuff if you're out there high drinking, you know. So I'm okay with all this. I'm just fine.
You know, that's great. Although the juice fasting, you're not fat. You're not doing that for weight. You're just doing that, to cleanse mind and body,
exactly.
Sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, good. And I'm glad are you healthy? Have you had any...
Yeah, I'm pretty. I haven't had any disastrous health issues.
Thank God. I mean, is the touring getting harder as you get older? Is it tough to get on the bus?
We just finished a month of January in the worst weather. I've been starting in Maine on January 2nd, the day that they closed all the airports. and we worked our way down the East Coast, and then this time I got some bronchitis. And the answer is you got to be really careful. And this is really an intense tour, with 4 days on and 1 day off traveling. And they travel every day and 4 hours sleep a night. So can take its toll on you later on, particularly when you get sick and getting sick at any age, getting sick at an older age.
But if you're being healthy, drinking kale juice and taking care of yourself, you can get through it.
Well, you're still out there, you still have things happen to you,
Well, yeah. But what will be happening with Jack Cassidy is that he will be at the Denver Oriental Theater with his good friend Jorma Kaukonen Sunday night, February 23rd. Go see them. By the way, also, you can pick up a DVD copy of the 70th birthday celebration of Jorma from Electric Hot Tuna. That's been out a couple of years, but it's still out there. You can still get it. And so what do you...
There's our new album, Steady As She Goes.
Steady As She Goes.
With that, you will get to hear the fabulous mandolin player that is on that album, Barry Mitterhoff, another nice boy, and play tenor guitar with us, or banjo, and
cool.
Mandolin, and hear his wonderful prowess in the instrument.
Well, speaking of musicians, last question here for the wonderful Jack Cassidy. I want to throw out a couple of names at you, and just the first things that come into your head about them. For example, Jaco Pastorius.
Well, Jaco was great. He had that unique approach to the instrument that puts him in a class all by himself. And, he's shaped so many jazz, electric, bass, guitar, jazz players. Really was the watershed, I think, for having that approach on the instrument. Jaco was sort of like the Eric Dolphy of the bass guitar.
Wow. And what about Jack Bruce of Cream?
Oh, Jack Bruce is fabulous. When I saw him sing and play in Cream, it was a musical highlight of approach, hearing a guy use all these lines and playing the bass guitar in combinations of notes with Eric Clapton and working with Ginger, and great groundbreaking.
What about Paul McCartney, another well-known bass player?
Paul is really the guy who started the concept that you can overdub a bass part and lock the track up. You can take a track, overdub where we get these melodic, compressed, big, fat, tube compression, melodic bass parts, sounds over top the track, inside the track and over top, but does it as a concept where he would orchestrate his bass part so that it would become a piece itself, and it would become like an orchestrated piece. And I think he really changed the landscape of just looking at the bass as a rhythm section instrument. Bo's trying to eat my drink, so I'm... get your nose away from that. And he's the only dog I know that will eat a salad.
Good for him. Well, dogs like carrots.
You know,
they do.
No, I'm talking greens. He'll just munch into a bunch of greens. He's not,
What do you think of the slap bass players, the folks like Flea and folks like them?
There's all kinds of ways to skin a cat out here. That slapping technique, when I had the Lifetime Achievement Award, I could see Larry Graham and all these great players out there, and it got to watch. I think there was one time there were 17 bass players on stage. It was, amazing. But I could see all these different approaches, and they're all great. It's not my approach, but I really appreciate what goes into it and the rhythmic combinations that come out there, the syncopated rhythm. aspects to lock in with a drummer on, and a lot of these modern sounding tracks would not sound that way without that technique.
Oh, that's a good point. And finally, I forgot to ask about John Entwistle of The Who.
Entwistle was great because I think, again, when you go back to tone, he had a tone with his rotor sound strings and his approach on the instrument and the way he'd hammer with the fingers that would give that definition to the low end that had the, put the power in a track. You would get that would put a lot of power into a recorded track, and I think he was the guy that started that out. He had a good sense of melody, but at the same time, I think the sound that came out of his playing in the track of his Who recordings really is what separated off from not sounding like other bands.
Very, very interesting stuff and powerful stuff from Jack Cassidy, talking about music, talking about bass players. Remember, Hot Tuna is going to be in Denver Sunday night, tomorrow night. Also, get the CDs and check the websites. Plus, if you want to learn some bass or some music, you can go to the Jorma Kaukonen Fur Peace Ranch. Was it once or twice a year that you do this?
Lately, I've been doing the opening and the closing. It runs from March to November.
March to November. And I guess final question for the delightful Jack Cassidy. Give us, please, and I know, again, a cliche thing, but one Woodstock memory.
One Woodstock memory. Okay, my favorite memory is just trying to get to the stage from the hotel, where we realized in the afternoon TV that the roads were closing like crazy. We piled everybody into the LTD. There was an access road into the stage that was used for tractors, in order to irrigate the fields and get access into all the fields. And there was cars parked on either side, all the way in to the stage. And I don't know, it was maybe about a mile and a half of cars. We started our journey, but for some reason, the cars parked to the left and the cars parked to the right were about an inch too close. And so,
yeah.
By the time we got to the stage with our LTD, we had no trim left on the car.
Oh my God, so you just shaved the whole side off the car just trying to get through?
A lot of shaving going on that day.
Well, except on people's faces, it was in 1969. Well, wow. Well, thank you for being part of Woodstock, part of Jefferson Airplane, part of the continuation of Hot Tuna, and for being one of the great bass players of all time. And thank you most of all for sharing your memories with us in the neighborhood. Jack Cassidy, just a joy to have you. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Rabbi. It's been a pleasure.
Shalom to you.